You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Margaret Atwood. It's the second interview we're doing on the occasion of her novel, The Robber Bride, recently published by Doubleday. We had ended up last time talking about World War II as being an origin point or a disruption of families metaphorically and causing the defect or the vulnerability point in the women in the book. Do you take that to be a political factor as well, or simply a metaphor for this book?
It's a life fact. That's what war does. And talk to anybody who has been through it, as, you know, say a young married couple. The guy goes off to war. The woman is left with the small kids. The guy comes back, supposing you're lucky, and he has been through something that has so profoundly altered him that it's like a different person. And they then have to deal with their altered relationship. My husband's father was a general in the Second World War, and he says that he doesn't know very many couples that actually survived, not during the war, but the return. And the ones that did so by starting another family.
Mm.
Otherwise, the life experiences had been so divergent that it was very, very hard for the man to deal with peace. You know, you find this a lot with people who have been through a war, that this experience has been so devastating for them. And the other thing that happens is they've had this hugely significant and altering and horrifying and adrenaline-packed experience, and they come back, and if the war is over, really nobody wants to know. That's over, it's gone, it's history.
I took it that the Gulf War was the inception point for this novel.
It begins on October the 23rd, 1990, when the war is imminent but hasn't yet happened. And the postscript takes us to a point beyond that war, when the war has happened and things are still smoldering and really nobody has won.
But it seemed as if, you know, it was... I forget who it is in the book mentions that we haven't had a war in a while and that the Gulf War is providing, you know...
Time to test out the weapons.
Yes.
Don't think that's not a factor.
But it seems as if the book was written in many ways as a reminder of the effects of war.
Mm-hmm. That too. There's a really excellent, well, of course, one of the writers on Tony's shelf.
Keegan.
Is John Keegan.
Mm-hmm.
And right after I published this book, he published an excellent book called A History of Warfare, which is really tip-top in going back over the ground. 35,000 years, how did we get to this point? Where did war come from on this scale? Who thought it up? It used to be ritual threatening battles. It's not that he's saying that people were never aggressive. They were always aggressive, but they had other ways of containing. They had ways of containing that aggression, limiting it. So where did the all-out kill-everybody war come from? And he's got some fascinating theories about that, but he also concludes by saying that probably that everybody in World War that we had in World War II, probably we won't have another one of those. So instead we will have local wars like the Gulf War with limited fields of action and limited numbers of participants. Yeah, it is a kind of reminder, but it also... The book is about our century in a way, and that's the event that's right in the middle of the century.
Mm-hmm.
We're still living with the political effects of it. You know, we're still living with the map that was rearranged by that war.
Well, I felt that this was a kind of ironic joke, that this was all's unfair in love and war, and that this book, The Robber Bride, was the attempt to construct families out of the impossibility of family as the consequence of the Second World War. And so that in each of the women, there's a space of psychic absence that a father once filled. Yeah.
Well, when you have damaged fathers, you usually have damaged mothers as well, it has to be said, or altered mothers. And certainly all of the mothers, Karis's mother, Tony's mother, and Roz's mother, they have all had an impact which has affected them in different ways. So all of it leaves a space. If you know your fairy tales, as I can see you do, you know that ghosts and witches cannot cross your threshold unless you invite them in. So each of the characters who has Xenia come into her life has issued a kind of invitation, whether she knows it or not. Xenia has knocked at the door. If you don't want to, if you have no psychic absence, you will say, no, thank you very much, I'm not taking any today. Mm-hmm. But each of them says, oh yes, come in. And they say that because Xenia has presented herself to each one of them as someone in need of help. In other words, she has come to the door as a wounded. And they, whether out of hubris or compassion, we do not know why the Good Samaritan stopped by the road. We don't know what the motives of that person were, but out of whatever motives, they take her in and try to deal with her.
Now,
She turns out to be the kind of man fallen amongst thieves who then makes off with the silverware after you've taken him in for the night.
When I was reading the first chapter of the book and trying to get my own bearings, I felt that to some extent all three of these women were disliked by their author.
Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no. No, I like all of them.
You see,
why did you think that?
Well, I'll tell you, it's an interesting thing. I came to think in a certain way that the first chapter of the book, in some unstated way, is Xenia's chapter. In that chapter, each of the women is presented in perhaps her most foolish aspect. Tony's study of war, Karis's spirituality, which is interpreted by Xenia as a kind of lunacy, and Roz's dress for success, seem to be subjected to the harshest scrutiny in the first chapter.
And I don't think it's the harsh picture. I think it's the surface picture.
Yes.
In other words, what you see and those snap judgments you make when you first encounter somebody, and then later on you may find out that were you ever wrong?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you have misjudged. And what the characters do in that section is they get each other wrong too. Each one of them thinks she's got the other ones pegged, and each one of them is wrong. Because then we go to the other one's point of view and find out that what they were thinking when character X thought they were thinking Y is not at all what they were thinking. They're also rather kind because each one of them decides to tackle Xenia on her own, feeling that the other two aren't up to it. You know, that they will spare their friends this ordeal which only they can handle, and they will go after Xenia on their own. And each one of them is, again, wrong about the others because each one of the others intends to do exactly the same thing. No, I don't dislike them in the least. Not in the least. I liked every single one of them, including Xenia.
Oh, well, I did think you liked Xenia.
I think the chapter that is Xenia's chapter is the dream sequence chapter. That's what I think. Because that is the chapter in which she appears in each one of their dreams. But you will notice that elements...
That is so interesting, because I felt that as I was reading, that images were coming from a sphere quite other than...
That's right. Each one of them has images in her dreams that have come from the lives of the other ones.
Yes.
So their dreams are, in fact, a kind of shared dream or mega dream in which Xenia is the recurring figure, although she comes in different disguises.
Oh, that's very pleasing to me. Because, you know...
Well, she is the shadow. She is the unconscious. So, of course, she would be...
She's the pool.
Queen of the dreams.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, but I'm the kind of reader, I guess, who tracks the appearance. Oh, didn't this coffee grinder appear somewhere else?
Yeah.
In fact,
well, there you go.
Yes.
And you will therefore know that the various articles of clothing and images in Roz's dream, some of them came from Tony and some of them came from Karis, and Karis has got things out of the other people's lives.
Now,
they're in a kind of communal dream.
Do you discover this in the process of writing?
I discover it in the process of writing, yeah. What I had at that point in the book, in case you're interested, what I struggled at and just finally decided could not work, I had Xenia's point of view as imagined by each of the others.
Ah.
That was just too complicated.
Uh-huh.
Because it still came through as Xenia's point of view, even though this was Xenia's point of view as imagined by Roz, or this was Xenia's point of view as imagined by Karis. You still thought that you were hearing the inside of Xenia's head, which, of course, you never can hear in this book. Because if you did, it would be quite a different book. It would be the magic show from behind the curtain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Margaret Atwood, the author of The Robber Bride. I thought I would let listeners in on... We were talking earlier about the cover of this book, which... Well, maybe you can describe it, because I loved what you said, and I thought
well,
that it would
help. Well, it
was
just found by accident by somebody working in the art department. We had intended to have quite a different cover, featuring, in fact, the dragon robe that appears here and there.
Oh, yes.
In the plot. But as it is, it's a hand, which, when you look closer, turns out to be not a real hand, but the hand of a mannequin. And it's holding what appears to be a playing card with an eye on it. And around its wrist is tied a beautiful bow with a kind of pinky edge to the ribbon. And my interpretation of it is, first of all, it's not a real hand, and the book is about illusion, so that is very fitting. Second, it's a left hand, which is also fitting to the book because there's a lot about the left side of everything. Xenia is from the left side. It's holding an eye, which means that the hand is quicker than the eye, because if the hand were not quicker than the eye, it wouldn't have been able to grab hold of that eye. And in the background, there's some shiny things, which when you look, turns out to be a pile of jewelry. And this is the robber bride, of course. And the bow has personal significance for me, because like every other little girl of my age, I was traumatized by the film The Red Shoes. And that thing on the ribbon is like her beautiful white ballet stockings when she gets hit by the train. And there's that kind of seepage taking effect.
I once read a word, it was apotropaic, and it meant a spell to ward off spells. And this book seemed to be a kind of exorcism.
Well, or else a sign that says, look in the package.
What do you mean?
Well, Xenia is a trickster figure and a con artist figure, and I'm thinking back through various stories of tricksters and con artists which have appeared, and one could make up quite a wonderful university course using such, and you would certainly put Becky Sharp in it, and The Confidence Man, and The Master Thief, another Grimm's tale, and Tales of Mercury, and Tales of Anansi the Spider God, and Tales
and
of...
Master and Margarita.
and Nana Bush and the Bergman film called The Magician. Anyway, there's a whole kind of thing about these people who are not what they seem to be. A film just came out called 6 Degrees of Separation,
yes,
which is a con artist trickster story. And the thing about tricksters in mythology is that they are also, although they're the gods of thievery and they fool people and they cause havoc, they are also the messengers of the gods. They also have something to say to you that you need to hear, and so does Xenia in this book. So the spell to ward off spells may be about confidence artists and looking in the package before buying it. Or if somebody offers you the Brooklyn Bridge, you better make sure they really own it, supposing you want to buy it.
But it also seemed, well, to be a request that you heal your wounds yourself before inviting others to enter into them, or something of the sort, that as you said before, that Xenia appears at the door, but there are sometimes, it seems, doors that are better left shut until you're ready to open them.
Yes. Well, thinking back again, there are a number of 19th-century poems about which door should, and novels about which door should be open and which closed. I'm thinking of Wuthering Heights and the huge importance of little fingers scratching at windows and which door people go through and who you invite in.
Or even at the beginning of Moby Dick, there are three inns, and Ishmael chooses the middle door.
That's right.
To the Spouter Inn. It's
yes, well, doors and caskets, things that you
yes.
open, are very important, and choosing the right one are very important, as you know, in folktale.
I know that Robinson Davies' Fifth Business trilogy, the middle volume, The Manticore, mm-hmm. is inspired by and structured along Jungian lines.
As are many of Davies' other things,
yes.
although it's not quite so obvious.
Yes. Is that of interest to you as well?
Well, let's put it this way. Given a choice of the three caskets, namely Freud, Jung, and Adler, most writers will pick the middle casket, Jung. Why? Because Jung got his stuff much more from literature and tale, and particularly, in my opinion, 19th century ballet and opera, than did the other two. For a writer, somebody who has based his analysis and psychology on literature is much more interesting than somebody who bases it on a body part. I mean, it just seems much, for a writer, it seems much richer and much more suggestive than the kind of reductionism, excuse me, Freudians, that you get in Freud for literary purposes. I mean, there's not much that you can do if you were a believer simply in the Oedipus myth and transference and all of those kinds of things. All you can do is write a kind of shrink novel. Whereas with Jung, since his primary material was what you're dealing with anyway, he just has much more to offer.
Well, it is interesting because the one thing of Freud that I do like is his analysis of Hoffman,
well,
the
there
essay
you go.
On the uncanny.
Of course. Yes. Because that's the one thing that is most Jungian in his work. Whereas Adler is much more attractive to businessmen.
But are you yourself interested in the things that interest Jung in alchemy, say?
Is pre-Jung.
Yes.
It's all pre-Jung. And anybody who deals with literature at any great length has to know about those things. Just as you have to know something about biblical exegesis, you have to know your basic Bible stories and what was made of them, because if you're going to study medieval mystery plays, you simply have to know that. If you're going to read Chaucer, you have to know it. If you're going to study at all in that area, everything up until about 1950, you simply have to know something about what those things mean. because writers besprinkle their texts with them. And if you're not going to be constantly running to the footnotes, it's better to just know the material. Similarly, you might as well know something about Virgil, and you might as well know something about Homer, because you can't avoid them. They're just always there.
I'm talking to Margaret Atwood on the occasion of the publication of The Robber Bride, and yet it seems to me, though, that the... I don't know how to put it, but the same person who loves, say, Narnia, mm-hmm. will love the Fairy Queen, but the person who, say, loves the Hardy Boys will go to Piers Plowman. You know, that there are different sensibilities.
The Hardy Boys person will go to Daniel Defoe.
Sure, except, you know, Daniel Defoe also
but
made
Ma
Flanders.
To me, one doesn't rule out the other. Mm-hmm. And probably that's what you were talking about when you said Robber Bride seems to be a structure that integrates all different kinds of levels, including what kinds of shoes people are wearing, which is a Defoe interest, mm-hmm. With what do these shoes mean in their archetypal being, which is a Jungian and Wizard of Oz interest. I've been interested in the Wizard of Oz for a long time as a kind of very... analyzable and resonant fable. I read the other books that he wrote, and they just don't come up to scratch at all. They're not the same. They're not in the same league.
It is odd. They sometimes, in Ozma toward the end, there are always elements. There's a woman with 100 heads that she mm-hmm. puts on at different times to be different
yes,
people.
Yes, but it's not all pulled together.
No, never, except in the first one. And, yeah. You know, and even there are all sorts of...
extraneous bits.
Yes.
Which, however, don't interfere because the structure is strong enough to hold it.
And because they weren't included in the movie, but when...
Now, stop that. I read the book long, long before
saw
the movie.
But I'm just thinking about the dainty China country... where the people are always breaking themselves to bits, and there are something called the quadlings.
I remember all of those, but here is something that will probably make all your hair stand up on end. My brother and I, when we were children, referred to cemeteries as dainty China countries.
Oh, thank you. Oh, that's great.
There's a dainty China country, because they would have these statues in them and those pointy things, you know, the little spires and minarets.
Well, Oz does seem to be made out of such disparate bits. It's impossible not to imagine the Emerald City in Baum's Yearning as Dublin, being, you know, an Irish man at heart and an immigrant. It was where, you know, he yearned to go. And it seems bits and pieces of all sorts of myths and political meanings and... you know, float through there, and I think it's what makes it so resonant, a kind of crazy...
What holds us together for me is the three figures that she goes to Oz with, each one of whom is an incomplete man. One of them is a kind of animal man, one of them is a robot, the woodman, and then we have the scarecrow who's mostly, his main interest is brain, but he's a man of straw. And then when she gets to Oz looking for Mr. Complete, he turns out to be very deficient as well.
Another confidence
so looked at
man.
From another con man. Looked at from a feminist point of view, could it be the American woman in search of a real man whom she can't find? There isn't one. Think of it that way. Make yourself shudder. All there are is real witches. The witches are real. They really do have power. Here we go with the sinister females again. Whereas the power of Oz is fraudulent. Mm-hmm. It's an imposition.
I always liked that he was, you know, almost paired with the hot air balloon. You know, he does seem to be a figure of, you know, rubbery self-inflation.
Yeah, but he says he's really just doing it for... the good of everyone. Another trickster.
We've been in trouble in this way before.
So you think it's about American politics and that this is the president?
Sometimes. And sometimes people have said that, you know, that the straw man is the farmer and that the tin man is the industrial man and that the lion is, you know, nature frightened of itself by its imposition, the impositions placed on it. But that's what makes it so profound. It's as if this Baum, who in so many other places, not just Oz, but Zixi of Ix and every other place, seemed so bereft, just a maker-up of things. Mm-hmm. Here, everything fits.
Well, it's the difference between imagination and fantasy, as defined by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And let me just remind you of Christabel with that very sinister female in It.
Absolutely.
Called Geraldine. I didn't think that was a terribly good name for her, but she's very sinister.
I'm very pleased. This brings up a question. How do you know when the pieces fit together?
How do you know when the pieces fit together? You
mean, yes.
How do you know that you're not just writing Zixi of Ix?
Yes.
Well, I think you spend a certain amount of time on your knees. You never know. You feel. And you hope that your feeling is an accurate feeling. But, of course, people say, well, writing is sort of like dreaming. It's not. Some of the impulses are, and some of the spontaneity and some of the things that come to you, you don't know how. But by the time a book is a book, it's been through a lot of rewriting and a lot of picking by your editor. So you have lots of time to reconsider, let us say. I guess you become what you hope is an intelligent reader of your own work. And if you come across something that doesn't fit, you say, why is this here? How did it get here? Should it be here? If it doesn't fit, maybe it should come out, or maybe I should try to find out why it's here and make it fit.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Margaret Atwood on the occasion of the publication of The Robber Bride from Doubleday. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Thank you very much for being with
us.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I could talk to you forever. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, books, books. Too.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.